You're listening to The Leonard Lopez Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In September last year, a young Afghan police recruit stepped into a gym at the Garmsirat police headquarters and shot and killed three U.S. Marines who were stationed there, training Afghans in the basics of policing. It was one of 48 attacks last year that came from inside the police force. Joining me now for a look at what happened on that September day and why training the police is key to U.S. plans for their future presence in Afghanistan is reporter Mathieu Aikens. His article, Friend or Foe, appears in the November-December issue of Mother Jones. I'm very pleased to welcome him to our show today. Hello.
Hey, how you doing, Lynn?
I'm well. Secretary of State John Kerry made a surprise visit to Afghanistan over the weekend to negotiate with President Hamid Karzai about the role of American forces after next year when the troop withdrawal is slated to begin. Were those talks successful at brokering an agreement?
Well, they haven't announced anything yet, but I think they're desperately trying to get something signed before the end of the year, because you have the presidential election coming up next year, and the military is actually starting to run up against some of the limitations of, you know, preparation. I mean, they need to know what they're going to be doing post-2014 in order to plan for it starting now.
Wasn't one of the sticking points in those talks the immunity of American soldiers from prosecution?
Yeah, that's one of the central issues. The other one is whether American forces, particularly special forces, will be able to unilaterally conduct night raids and other missions.
If no agreement is reached, the alternative is a complete U.S. withdrawal at the end of 2014. And then what happens?
Well, I don't think anyone is seriously wishing for that, because it would probably lead to a dramatic decline in the capability of the Afghan government to stabilize the country and protect itself against the insurgency, and would probably be, catastrophic for U.S. interests in the region as well, at least as they conceive of it.
Well, why has training in the Afghan army and security forces been such a big challenge? Is this a matter of corruption, as we've seen in so many other instances in Afghanistan?
Well, as I write in the piece, it goes back to the deal that President Obama struck with the generals when he came into office over the surge. You know, he was reluctant to do the surge in Afghanistan. He was skeptical, and his advisors were skeptical that, a major military effort would produce any results. But the military was adamant that was the correct answer to the problem. And so the deal was, you can go big, but you have to go fast, right? He authorized a troop surge, but it had to be out within 2 years. And so the whole thing has been done in a very compressed timeline, but it's had an extremely, high ambitions. So, for example, they wanted to expand the Afghan National Security Forces, but it basically doubled them to, almost 300,000 within a few years. So in order to make that timeline and those goals, you've had to just shovel all sorts of people into the security forces. Some of them have turned out to be Taliban, infiltrators. Others were just mentally disturbed, or the quality of recruits has been so low and the turnover has been so high that it's made training them an extreme challenge.
The attrition rate is high enough that a third of the army is replaced every year. And haven't Afghan recruits been targeted by the Taliban? Or is that something that we saw more in Iraq?
The thing is that As they say, as they call these attacks that happen against, when Afghans turn on their American allies, we call them green-on-blue attacks, after the sort of military term. But the green-on-green attacks, so, of Afghans turning on themselves is actually much worse. And so you have instances where an Afghan recruit will be an infiltrator for the Taliban, and at night he'll go and take his gun and shoot all the other police officers in the post that they're in, and then flee and join the Taliban. The recruits, once a family, they're from rural areas that are heavily influenced by or controlled by the Taliban, then pressure will come on the family if their son joins the security forces. So in some of these cases, in some of these insider attacks, it seems to be evidence that that's what happened, is that the Taliban were able to get to the recruit through the family and turn them against American forces.
Well, there had been a handful of the green-on-blue killings starting in 2007, but does anyone know why the number suddenly mushroomed in 2012?
Well, that's the interesting thing, is that you would think that if it was simply a matter of, say, cultural incompatibility or Afghans being angry about the presence of, you know, NATO forces or even just the opportunity, because there were so many more U.S. and NATO forces, it would have started with the surge. You would have seen this mushroom in 2009 and 2010 when the bulk of the surge forces came into the country. But instead, it actually didn't really start happening in the level we saw it at until 2011, 2012. And, you know, as I write in the piece, what happened was that sudden mushroom actually maps onto the mushrooming in something called partnering, where they stuck whole units together. They stick a whole company of American grunts and Afghan soldiers together and have them live cheek by jowl on a base.
So are they just rubbing each other the wrong way?
I think that's part of it. You know what I mean? I think that the opportunity suddenly became much greater. You know, because they were, at least in the beginning. You know, now it's changed a lot because of these attacks. But there was unrestricted access. You could just walk from the American into the Afghan side of the base, right? And so everyone's armed. There's weapons everywhere. In any army that has poor discipline and low morale and corruption, you have a problem of fratricide. Of soldiers killing each other, the superiors. I mean, you had it in the American military in Vietnam, right? So exposing American soldiers to the Afghan army in this way and the police, I think, is what led to the increase that you saw in 2011, 2012, that you didn't see in 2009, 2010, when partnering was much less, when U.S. troops were fighting on their own, as they did in Iraq mostly.
You mentioned that the Taliban have infiltrated the army and police. Did that have any connection to the rise in attacks?
Yeah, I think the Taliban started to understand that as these attacks began to increase. I think the Taliban really made it a priority. In fact, I've heard from senior intelligence officials in the country that there had been a decision taken by the senior Taliban leadership to make this a priority because they saw what kind of outsized strategic impact these kind of attacks could have. You know, it's an act of betrayal that has much larger repercussions than, say, a soldier who gets killed in battle, right? It sows mistrust. It causes the public back home to question why the soldiers are there in the first place. For example, in the case of, the French, there was an insider attack that killed some French soldiers, and that actually led to them increasing to them leaving sooner than they had planned it. They were planning to leave anyways. They accelerated the pace of their withdrawal, and they're now out of Afghanistan in a combat role. And then-President Sarkozy actually cited, he said, French soldiers are not in Afghanistan to be killed by Afghan allies.
My guest is Matt Akins. His article, Friend or Foe, appears in the November-December issue of Mother Jones. Late last month, there was another green-on-blue attack that killed three coalition soldiers. It was the first one since July. Have the number of attacks been down this year?
Yes, they've definitely been down this year. If you ask the military why that is, they'll say it's because the Afghans improved their vetting and counterintelligence, and there's better awareness and security procedures on both sides. And I think that might be true to some extent, but mostly it has to do with the drastic curtailment of partner operations. I mean, when I embedded the military forces late last year, it was just astonishing. You know, I've been reporting from the country for five years now. It was just astonishing the level of isolation that the Americans and the Afghans were living, you know, from each other. Like, their bases were physically closed off from each other. When the Americans went over to visit the Afghans, they put on all their body armor and helmets and guns and basically got locked and loaded like they're going out on a combat mission. And they spent very little time with them. Whereas before, you know, a couple of years before, they'd be living together. They would be eating meals together. They would be talking in the evening, joking around, playing sports together, volleyball or something like that. So that is pretty much across the board. These very drastic measures have been taken to reduce exposure to the Afghans. And, of course, this is completely, you know, across purposes with the training mission, right? If you're trying to train people and teach them and mentor them and advise them, then you need to be able to spend time with them.
Well, this spring, Afghan forces took over nominal responsibility for combat operations. Has that reduced the number of joint operations and the opportunity for insider attacks?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you have Afghans. This is really the first fighting season where you could say that the Afghans took a prominent role. You know, it's in some cases a lead role, but certainly a prominent role, and they're doing stuff on their own. So that means that there's been less contact out on missions as well as on bases.
But was the military surprised by these attacks? This is unlike anything that it had to deal with in Vietnam or Iraq.
Yeah, I think they were surprised. I think they were in denial at first, you know, saying that these were isolated incidents that, you know, were just the result of a cultural clash or an individual, disagreement. So it took them a while, I think, to respond in a sort of organized way. And also, I think they were reluctant to curtail partnering because it was so central to their go big but go fast strategy of building up the Afghan forces so that they could leave. So I think there was a reluctance to understand the bigger picture of this on the part of the military in the beginning.
Well, has there been any pattern to this whole thing? Have the perpetrators come from a particular area, an ethnic group, or a tribe? Do they have many of them turned out to have links to the Taliban?
Well, you know, as I read in the piece, they've come from every ethnic group and every tribe, every region in Afghanistan. They range from teenagers to elderly men. They've come from every branch of service in the Afghan forces. So it's a very diverse phenomena, which is why it was so confusing at first. But there are, yeah, there are trends. They do tend to come mostly from areas, you know, inhabited by the Pashtun ethnic group, where the Taliban are stronger. And some of them definitely, you know, do have links to the Taliban or organized plots. You know, some of them, they had escape plans ready. Others were spontaneous acts. I mean, there's a kind of mysteriousness to this phenomena. It's still not fully understood why it happens. It's sort of like compared to suicide, right? You know, a lot of people, when they kill themselves, they've done it because, you could say they've done it because they're depressed or because their loved one left them or they had mental illness or whatever, right? But there's lots of people like that, and only a tiny fraction of them kill themselves, and you never really fully understand why that individual did it. This phenomenon is not unlike that. You know, we don't fully understand why a particular individual did what they did.
Your article focuses on an attack in August of last year at the Garmsur headquarters of the Afghan National Police, in which three U.S. Marines were killed. We're going to take a little break. When we come back, we'll look at the circumstances of that event. My guest is Metra Akins. His article, Friend or Foe, appears in the November-December issue of Mother Jones. We are back with Metra Akins, whose article, Friend or Foe, also subtitled Portrait of an Afghan Assassin, is in the November-December issue of Mother Jones. And let's talk about that event last August when three U.S. Marines were killed in the Garmsur headquarters of the Afghan National Police. What were the relations between the U.S. Marines and their Afghan trainees like before the attack?
Well, they were a bit tense because, you know, this was well into the phenomena, so there had already been lots of insider attacks that summer, almost an epidemic of them. And the Marines were very conscious that the Afghans they were living with were actually a greater threat to them than the Taliban, who weren't really, you know, very active in the district. So they were on their guard, but obviously, you know, it wasn't enough, and they were still hanging out and talking and working out in the gym next to them. And so I think there was, you know, there was still some friendliness between them, but also some friction.
Well, the whole idea of putting them together is to develop some sense of bonding, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, but the thing is I think that really that was a naive hope. In general, I found when I traveled to these places, these bases, that, you know, just expecting an 18-year-old kid from Oceanside or from, you know, Minnesota or wherever, and an 18-year-old kid from some village in Afghanistan to get along, to like each other when there's so much, you know, differences and culturally, it was just naive. You know, I think there was some trainers, some Afghan, some American, you know, officers or people who were maybe a little more culturally attuned who did develop great relations with Afghans. I think there's other instances where, you know, maybe in the heat of combat, some very strong bonds are forged. Absolutely. But on the whole, just lumping together big units of grunts from America and grunts from Afghanistan was a recipe for a lot of friction, a lot of, you know, conflict.
Well, had the shooter, and I'm not sure how to pronounce his name, is it Ainuddin or Ainuddin?
Ainuddin,
had he been at the Garmsir headquarters for a long time?
No, he was a relatively recent arrival, which is one reason why they suspected it might have been a Taliban involvement in these killings. But he had been bouncing around to different police stations. He was sort of a runaway from home, and then he showed up at Garmsir, and about a week and a half later, this incident, he killed three Marines.
He arrived as part of the entourage of a new police chief, Sarwar Jan. And the Marines were wary of John, weren't they?
They were. You know, he had been forced out of previous postings by the Marines for his corruption and incompetence. And they also accused him of being a pedophile, of molesting young boys, T-boys, having them around. So the Marines, you know, they knew about this guy when he came. But, of course, the Afghan government makes its own appointments. And unfortunately, especially in a place like Helmand, which is the opium-producing capital of the world, if the province was its own country, it would produce the majority of the world's opium. It is a very corrupt place, and individuals like Sarwar Jan thrive.
And hadn't Ainuddin told a cousin that he'd been physically abused by some of his brothers?
Yes, yeah, he did. He said they would beat him, and he was sort of a half-brother, so I think he was mistreated at home as well.
Because you found Ainuddin's family, and what did they tell you about him?
They said it was interesting. You know, I went to visit his family in the provincial capital, Lashkargah. They told me that, I mean, I think they cared about him. I think they were quite sad about what happened, even if they weren't treating him very nicely. They said that he was really very intelligent. You know, the family wasn't educated. The brothers weren't literate even. But Ainuddin was a diligent student, and he liked to read. And he had been writing. Well, they said that he was writing poems because poetry is very popular in this culture. And when I asked to see them, they actually brought a book that turned out to be his diary, which is extraordinary. It's not a culture where writing and introspection is very common. So to find the diary of this kid was remarkable. Thing and really gave me kind of a window into his psychology.
He also had quite a temper, didn't he?
He did. And I don't know if that was a result of how he was treated at home or his natural temperament or he got into a motorcycle accident about a year before these incidents happened. And his family says that, you know, after he had his head injury, his behavior changed. But yeah, he did have a temper. He got into fights at home with his mother and brothers, which is why he ran away. He once, shot a dog because he got mad at it when he was with the police. One of the police told me. So yeah, he had an anger problem. It seems.
Where is Ainuddin now?
Right now, Ainuddin is in jail. He's locked up at Bagram Airfield. There's a detention facility there that is normally under the control of the Afghan government, but I think there's a number of prisoners that the Americans are sort of still processing and dealing with their cases, and I believe he's one of them. But right now the Naval Criminal Investigative Service, which is the branch of the Navy that investigates criminal acts within the military, they are trying to bring Ainuddin back to America to stand trial, something that's never been done before. I think because when I talked to the father of one of these Marines, Greg Buckley Sr., he and other people are very concerned that if Ainuddin is given over to the Afghan justice system, he might be, you know, given a very lenient sentence or even released.
What did Greg Buckley Roberts Jr.'s father tell you about what his son had told him about the deployment?
He told me and another Marine that I spoke to who were there on the deployment with him, you know, said the same thing, that it was, they just felt it was a waste of time. They were there hanging out with these Afghan police who really didn't want them to be there, who, you know, thought the Americans were a nuisance, really. I mean, insofar as they would give them equipment or supplies, they were happy to take them, but they didn't really want the Americans to be around looking over their shoulder, pestering them to do training sessions. And the stuff they were teaching them was so basic, like how to apply a tourniquet or use handcuffs, that it didn't seem to make sense to them that they were over in Afghanistan risking their lives to do this.
Hadn't he grown more and more anxious about the Afghan officers that they were training?
He had. He expressed, you know, real fears to his father and to others that one of them could turn on them. And he had gotten into an argument with an Afghan police officer that had left him badly rattled. So they were all kind of fearing for something like this.
And the victims were about to come home.
They were. They were literally, a few days from leaving the country. So they were all ready, and maybe that's one reason they got complacent. They were all dreaming of home. They couldn't wait to be home.
I'm talking with Mathieu Aikens, whose article Friend or Foe appears in the November-December issue of Mother Jones. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. How did the attack change procedure at Garmsir and in other ISAF operations?
Well, we discussed this earlier. When I went to Garmsir, so I traveled a bit with the American military and also on my own and visited and spoke to the police. They had completely changed operations. So before, the police station was a two-story building that was sort of on one side of this bigger compound where there's American troops and Afghan army troops. So before, the American trainers who trained the police would live on the second floor. The Afghans would live on the first floor. And then obviously after this incident happened, the Americans packed up and left. And now they live like on the other side of the base, and they just get suited up and they get their rifles and put on their body armor and walk over to the police station and spend, you know, maybe an hour or two there and then go back. So they're spending much less time in contact with them. And there's obviously a very strong climate of suspicion and distrust.
But you say that the result of the protective measures that the ISAF put in place has been to leave the Afghan strategy half finished. Is there any way to complete the strategy? Time is running out.
Time is running out, and, you know, it's a huge concern because they've created this enormous military force that's ill-trained, it's corrupt, it's expensive, and the country is going to be saddled with all these armed men. And there's not really a good strategy for dealing with that, especially if, you know, relations between the Americans and the Afghan government continues to deteriorate and you have a reduced or even no presence post-2014, it's really the Afghans who are going to be cleaning up the mess from the strategy.
Because the training of Afghan police is key to our ability to bring combat troops home, and we're scheduled to withdraw them all by next year.
That's right. Well, we're going to bring them home regardless. There's no doubt about that. The question is what we're leaving in place. You know, is it a viable state that can protect itself and its citizens, or is it something that's going to turn on itself, where, you know, you're going to have this army that's a danger to the state itself?
The police training is just one piece of the resources that the Americans have committed to building up Afghanistan's infrastructure. Are the other pieces, schools and roads, among other things, also going to be left half finished?
Some of them. There's no doubt that, you know, some good things, wonderful things have been done in the country by people, you know, focused on development work. But, for example, the police station in Garmsir was this expensive building, you know, built by contractors that had a huge generator plant that ran the plumbing. And, you know, people don't have plumbing in rural areas in Afghanistan. So the whole thing was, like, falling apart, you know. while when I went to visit it, the toilets were a nightmare. They had no, someone had stolen all the fuel. They had no fuel for the generators to run the plumbing, and the building was just in shambles already. So there's a lot of, we built a lot of expensive facilities and you know, infrastructure that really will not last for very long once we leave, and are colossal wastes of taxpayers' money.
Are the United States and Afghanistan both basically stuck with each other for the time being? I mean, Afghanistan needs help and support for its security operations. The United States needs Afghanistan not to backslide. I mean, a lot of people have suggested that once we leave, the Taliban will just march right back in, and we're going to have maybe not the same situation we had before the invasion, but not a very good situation either.
Well, I don't think the Taliban are going to march right back in, but you could have a gradual collapse of the state in Afghanistan. And, of course, the whole region, you know, is really important to the U.S. I really hope that, you know, Afghanistan and America realizes that they do still need each other, and they need to work in constructive ways together to bring peace and development to the region and not proxy wars. And I hope that U.S. strategy doesn't end up being, you know, flying drones to bomb people there, you know, out of aircraft carriers in the Arabian Sea. I hope that the development and political aspects of our engagement there remain strong, and that we don't revert to sort of purely military or counterterrorism lens of viewing the country. But that remains to be seen.
Well, when you mentioned proxy wars, we're talking about Pakistan as well, and to some degree India, aren't we?
Yeah, Pakistan and India do have, there's a dynamic between them in Afghanistan, though I think it can be exaggerated because India doesn't really have that nearly as strong a presence as Pakistan does, and Pakistan is more concerned, I think, with the stability of the border zone and the fact that it's got out of control in their own tribal areas bordering Afghanistan than they are with the Indian presence in Afghanistan. But, of course, there's also Iran. You know, the U.S. has a lot of interest in having, you know, presence in Afghanistan as a way to contain Iran, right? We're flying a tremendous number of covert and surveillance operations out of Afghanistan that are targeting Iran. So I the point is that this kind of militaristic strategy that puts, you know, counterterrorism and pressuring Iran first, you know, as the primary U.S. aims in the region, I think are counterproductive, because what's really important is to achieve lasting political stability and peace in Afghanistan and the region in general.
Matthew Akin's article, well, we've been saying friend or foe, but the actual title in front of the article is Portrait of an Afghan Assassin. A subtitle, No One Is Sure What Made a 17-Year-Old Poetry Writing Cop Gun Down Four Marines. It is in the November-December issue of Mother Jones, and we have a link to it on our show page at WNYC.org. Matt, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure, Warren.